Jim O'Neill, developer evangelist in Microsoft's Northeast District, and this is the first of a multi-part session in which we'll talk about some facets of SQL Server with which all developers should be familiar. It's an adaptation of a session I delivered in March 2009 as part of our quarterly Northeast Roadshow. The presentation took a top five reasons approach, so each session will explore one of those reasons. Let's get started with reason number five. On a CLR day, you can SQL forever. First off, apologies to Barbara Streisand for the first bad pun of this series. There will be more. What we're talking about here, of course, is the presence of the .NET CLR, Common Language Runtime, in SQL Server. .NET support was introduced into SQL Server 2005, which installs the 2.0 CLR. SQL Server 2008 installs the .NET 3.5 SP1 CLR. However, the functionality exposed for the purposes of our discussion here is at the 2.0 level. The 3.5 installation is in deference to some optional business intelligence capabilities that we won't be talking about today. To enable use of the programmatic CLR capabilities, like stored procedures and triggers in C# and VB, you or your DBA needs to enable them explicitly via spconfigure. This is a server-wide setting, so once enabled, you're good to go regardless of what database you're working with on the server. SQL Server 2008 introduces a number of new data types, including three that are implemented as .NET CLR types. Hierarchy ID is used to capture hierarchical relationships, like an organization chart or bill of materials, in a relational database model. Geometry is a spatial type that captures points and regions on an infinite XY plane, while geography is a spatial type that reflects points and regions, taking into account the curvature of the Earth. Note, all of these types are available whether or not the Enable CLR configuration switch has been turned on. As I mentioned before, that switch merely enables or disables user code, such as for procedures and triggers. Along with these .NET types comes programmatic support in the SQL Server.types namespace. Although keep in mind that constructs introduced in .NET 3.0 and later, like Link and the Entity Framework, are not yet supported. You should also be aware that there's a number of other new data types in SQL Server 2008 to make your lives as developers easier. Refined date types and the file stream, for instance. But they don't directly leverage the .NET CLR, so we won't be focusing on them here. So let's start by looking at the hierarchy ID type. This slide captures a small session in SQL Server Management Studio, a great tool to experiment with queries and SQL Server capabilities, by the way. If it's not part of your arsenal of tools as a developer, it probably should be. Here I've run two different queries against the AdventureWorks 2008 database. From the one at the top, you can see that the organization node column of the employee table has a data type of hierarchy ID, and its value represents the level of that employee in the reporting structure. The WHERE clause leverages a static method called getRoot to get the employee at the top of the chain, in this case the CEO. The second query seems a bit more complex, but much of that comes from the need to join the employee and person table to relate a person with their business entity ID, a side effect of the normalization of the AdventureWorks database. In that query, I'm doing a subselect from the employee table and using the getAncestor method to find the employee whose organization node is at a level 2 higher than the current employee, namely his or her skip-level manager. As you can see from the sidebar here, there's a number of additional methods you can call to navigate the hierarchy, as well as to insert new nodes into the mix. Let's move on to the first of the spatial types added to SQL Server 2008. The geometry type models an infinite XY plane, and so is suitable for capturing warehouse floor layouts or local maps, for instance. It does not incorporate the curvature of the Earth, so isn't suitable for covering large geographical areas. In this sample, I've created two T-SQL variables of the geometry type and initialized them via a string in what is called well-known format. Internally, they're stored in a binary format, but you can use the toString method to get a human-readable value. In this example, we've got two polygons here, a triangle and a rectangle. Note the well-known format for an n-gon includes n plus 1 points, where the last point is the same as the first. Symbol points and lines are also supported. And the cool part about using these types are the rich methods that allow you to determine how elements interact via intersections, unions, container ship, and so on. And these methods are simply implemented on the underlying column type, so using them in SQL is quite straightforward. The second of the spatial types is the geography type, which captures points, lines, and regions, but on a global scale, accounting for the curvature of the Earth, as well as spatial reference systems. So here I use a well-known format to define a region, not in terms of XY coordinates, but in terms of latitude and longitude. The magic number 4326 is the spatial reference ID, which in this case is the same as used by GPS systems. The idea is important here since computations between geography types with different SRIDs are completely invalid and will result in an exception. Geography types also have a couple of other restrictions stemming from underlying algorithms and calculations made to support them. For instance, an element cannot span more than a hemisphere, and points defining a region must be specified counterclockwise. Breaking these rules will result in an exception as well. Here, what I've done is define a region and then queried AdventureWorks for all stores with a location, namely the spatial location column, that intersect that region. You're viewing the results here in a freeware program called GeoQuery 2008, which you can download from the web. Its capabilities are somewhat of a subset of those of SQL Server Management Studio, but it has one very cool additional feature, the ability to superimpose geography result set data on a map. SQL Server Management Studio has a display that provides only latitude and longitude lines, so it's not quite as easy to visualize the result. Beyond the data types, you can also leverage the .NET CLR for logic that you write in the form of stored procedures, user-defined functions and types, triggers, and aggregates. This is where enabling the CLR, which I described earlier, is required. Within the code for any of these items, you can use constructs similar to ADO.NET. However, they apply to a SQL context, which you can consider a wrapper for the processing within the server acting on behalf of the client. The SQL context has access to information on the client identity and can pass result sets from stored procedures, for instance, back to the client via the pipe object. As a simple example, here's the complete code for an aggregate function called concatenate that takes all the values of a given field in a group by query and concatenates them. An aggregate has a specific structure, including the methods you see here, accumulate, merge, and terminate. A stored procedure, in contrast, would be one method, whatever you wanted to call it, and however you wanted to implement it. The attributes on my structure here mark it as an aggregate, so when I deploy it from Visual Studio, the requisite T-SQL to create the assembly reference and register the function within SQL Server is done automatically. But of course you can issue the SQL yourself if all you have is the runtime assembly. Assemblies for programmatic entities you build are stored in the database itself, backed up as other entities are, and visible within the SQL Server Management Studio. And when you go to use them, it's no different than invoking their T-SQL equivalent, as you can see here, in this example, to concatenate multiple phone numbers for each person. Bringing in the CLR to execute your code within SQL Server may raise some concerns, specifically in the areas of reliability, scalability, security, and performance. So let's look at each of those in turn. While you could write malicious code, well, not you personally, of course, there are some safeguards to prevent, say, an errant C# stored procedure from bringing the database to its knees. Code deployed to SQL Server must be verifiably type-safe, so no unsafe pointers, for instance. Code also executes within app domain boundaries, so is insulated from the core server and from other clients running SQL Server tasks. Lastly, host protection attributes are in place to keep stupid things from happening. For example, let's say you accidentally leave a message box function in your stored procedure code. That method has an HPA that says it can't run within a CLR-hosted environment, as SQL Server provides, so you won't get to production to find a message box waiting for a reply in some locked server room 1,000 miles from your office. Obviously, a database server must be highly scalable and be able to handle threading, context switching, and memory management efficiently. Both SQL Server and the .NET CLR have constructs for dealing with thread scheduling and memory management, so there's a bit of a marriage that takes place here. When CLR code runs inside of SQL Server primitives control the threading and the memory management. This helps ensure that constructs you introduce can be kept in line by the server. Likewise, although SQL Server generally uses a cooperative threading model, managed code runs preemptively, allowing SQL Server to identify and kill runaway CLR threads. Somewhat related to reliability is the concept of security. When you deploy a procedure, function, trigger, or attribute, you assign a permission set, essentially one of three values. Safe, the default, gives your code the permission to do essentially whatever you do in T-SQL, access data, process cursors, and so on. If your code needs a little bit more functionality, like interoperating with the registry or perhaps making service calls over the network, the external access mode is appropriate. The most open level is unsafe. That name alone should make you think twice about whether your code needs that much power. Now, what about performance? When you think of .NET, you think of IL, just-in-time compilation, and other things that are great for productivity and portability, but perhaps not so great for performance. However, when you build .NET CLR constructs like triggers and the such, there's a bit of extra help you get in producing well-performing code. For example, a marshalling stub created as part of the assembly eliminates the need for reflection and boxing of types at runtime. Additionally, what SQL Server actually interacts with at runtime is a native function pointer, thus eliminating an additional potential performance hit. I'm going to end this session and each of the other four in this series with a general list of do's and don'ts to provide some guidance for incorporating the topic at hand in your development efforts. Obviously, each situation is different, but hopefully these short lists will provide some food for thought as you start using the functionality we've been discussing. So for this presentation, I start by noting that CLR programmatic constructs are generally recommended over T-SQL, so for compute-intensive operations as well as those involving cursors, on the basis of increased performance. Going forward, Microsoft is also encouraging that extended stored procedures be replaced by CLR procedures. One area in which you may want to reconsider the use of the SQL CLR is when building constructs that primarily access data via the SQL context object we talked about earlier. In general, T-SQL still provides more efficient data access. At a higher level, as with any application of high throughput, you want to minimize synchronization points. So in procedures, triggers, and the such that you're building with VB and C#, be aware of the use of static constructs and access to serialized resources. Lastly, although you could conceivably build SQL CLR data types to abstract the relational constructs directly in the database, that's not really leveraging the strength of the CLR features or of SQL Server itself. Use an object relational mapping tool like the Entity Framework or nHibernate to provide that level of abstraction and maintain an appropriate separation of concerns. That ends this first segment of what's important for developers to know about SQL Server. I hope you'll join me for the rest of them. Thanks and have a great day.